Hi, this is Larry H. Russell with a message on behalf of the network. As the leading online provider of audio-video coverage of the Boston Celtics, CLNS Radio delivers fans the most provocative discussion and analysis from the most noted personalities in the Celtics realm of the World Wide Web. Home to the number one rated weekly podcast which covers the NBA's winningest franchise, Celtics Beat is released first thing every Sunday morning. We deliver the hottest of takes and get the lowdown on all things Celtics from players, league executives, and the biggest names in the national basketball media. And it doesn't end there. The original Celtics podcasters John Duke and Justin Poulin have returned. Available Mondays on CLNSradio.com, Celtics Stuff Live is back and better than ever before with featured guests that are the most familiar voices to Celtics Nation. Basketball in Boston is heating up and you don't want to miss any of this. Download the CLNS Radio mobile app now. Available for your iPhone and Android.
Can you believe it? We are back from Syracuse University. It is the Bobcast, a weekly tour of sports and pop culture. And before we get going, let's give a little shout out to our sponsor, Loot Crate. Loot Crate, as always, a very esteemed sponsor of the Bobcast. And this month they are offering a horror package. October is going to be a scream with horror. They're going to get your spine tingling with a crate full of classic and contemporary thrills and chills, the horror package. The deadline to get that is October 19th, lootcrate.com/CLNS. We're offering you a special deal. The good folks at CLNS Radio are offering you a special deal this month. You have 14 days, 4 hours to get your horror package just in time for Halloween. Remember, Loot Crate has exclusive geek and gear items that you cannot find anywhere else. That's it for Loot Crate, and we are on to our show. For the first time in Bobcast history, we have a repeat guest coming back onto our airwaves, and it's only fitting because his last appearance on the show was abbreviated. He had airplanes flying over his head, a dying battery. It was a race against time, and he did not win, as we often lose to time in this world. But now he's inside, he's comfy, he's cozy. We have Tony Capobianco back with us today, and we'll bring him in just a second. But first, a little update on the situation at hand here. Celtics are back. It's unbelievable, but last night we actually got to watch some Celtics basketball. Joel Embiid looking like the real deal. To be fair, Evan Turner, I saw him the other night drilling threes for Portland. I don't think we're going to see that in the regular season. There's a lot of weird things that happen in the preseason that I don't think are going to translate to the regular season. But as far as just the eye test goes, the good old reliable eye test, Embiid looked like a monster last night. Of course, he was bodying Tyler Zeller. But nevertheless, I'm loving what I see from him. The Celtics, you know, very strong start. Horford really looks like a guy who's going to be able to glue everything together there. But enough of that. Like I said, tomorrow I'll have coverage of the Celtics preseason second game against the Hornets. Already watching twice as much preseason basketball as I ever watched in my life. That shows you just how excited I am for this season. Here's a guy who might be somewhat less excited for his basketball season. Last time on the air, he made the bold claim that Kevin Durant would be returning to the Oklahoma City Thunder. Last night, we saw him wearing a different uniform, the Golden State Warriors. I'm sad. He's sad. Let's bring him aboard, Tony Capobianco. Tony, what happened? Where did your claim go wrong?
I don't know. I mean, it's not like I was the only one to say that he is most likely going to stay. I mean, financially, it made the most sense. He just like LeBron did to Cleveland, just threw a curveball at us and actually went to Golden State. And by the way, have you seen Stephen A. Smith on First Take today?
No, I did not.
Preseason game, and he loses his mind, and it's just lamenting that Kevin Durant has ruined the regular season for him.
Oh, it's mind-blowing, though. And, you know, I'm the first person to say a preseason is a load of garbage. Nothing you see there matters, especially in the NBA. Like, we always talk how awful the preseason action is in the NFL. I think the NBA is even worse. It's just a bunch of guys walking up and down the court, throwing up open jump shots. Last night was an absolute joke. What did they end up winning by in the end? It was like 50 when I was watching in the third quarter.
There was like a little like squiggly infinity looking sign by their score. It's like infinity. I think it broke the scoreboard. I think the Vegas closed, shut down for like a minute.
It's absurd. So I know you just came out saying Stephen A. Smith thinks the regular season's over. Just from seeing how it looked when it comes together, all that talent, all the space on the floor, I don't know how anyone's going to be able to stop them. It's absurd to think about the fact that that was one of their chief competitors in the Western Conference, and they came out and won by an infinity amount of points, as you put it. But shifting gears back towards your expertise with the Enid News covering the Oklahoma City Thunder, they're off in Spain playing Barcelona. Have you gotten a chance to, you know, see how they're looking in action so far?
Have not paid attention to it. I'll probably get a better look because, like I said, it's preseason. I'll have a better look at them when they come down and they're taking on Minnesota for like a little season preview. For me, I'm actually a little more excited for this season than I was before because you get a little idea. Actually, I had like a little bet with one of my friends who covers sports in LA that he thinks the Thunder will make the playoffs or will be like a late seed. I think they'll still win their division because really all they got to do is beat Portland, and they're pretty much built the same way as Portland, which is better bigs.
I'll agree with you.
So that's my little personal interest into it. Also, I got nothing to worry about with the Thunder because we got the coalition of the willing. We got 40 nations ready to roll, son.
Well, we're both fighting against the big dogs, the Celtics with the Cavaliers, and you guys are going to be going up against the Warriors. What kind of reception in the Oklahoma City community do you think Durant's ultimately going to get on that day when he returns?
We have a town in Oklahoma called Durant, which is a little more like east of OKC. There was a petition, there's an actual petition to rename that state, that city Durant. They wanted to call it Westbrook.
Wow. There's actually a city called Durant outside Oklahoma City?
There's a town called Durant. It's kind of like an hour maybe east of Oklahoma City. Small town, maybe like a 1,000 tops of people. And there's a petition that went around to rename that place to Westbrook because Westbrook signed an extension.
That's crazy. Has it always been called that, or is that like?
Yeah. So, I mean, wow. I mean, this part of the country, you got a lot of towns that are pretty much named after first names. I know there's actually an Anthony, Kansas. And if you go down to Texas, almost all the towns are named after first names. You got Tyler, Texas. You have like Humboldt, Texas. You got, I'm sure if you look close enough, you'll probably find like a Teddy, Texas or something like that.
Wow, that's crazy. We know you're the guy to talk to for all things Thunder in that area, or one of the guys. What else are you know, looking forward to this fall from a coverage perspective with Enid?
Well, we got on Big 12. We're pretty much at this point the heart of the Big 12 because we have Oklahoma went to the playoff last year. They still have a shot Big 12 wise. I think they're 1-0. They're on top. Then they take on Texas in the Red River Shootout, which is turned into a loser leaves town match essentially. Whoever loses the game could probably lose their job. Now, Charlie Strong has been on the hot seat ever since he got hired. Some say it's racial, some say it's something else. It's kind of like the Rich Rodriguez treatment in Michigan. And Bob Stoops, I don't think the people in Oklahoma, and I feel the same way with my Arizona Wildcats and Rich Rodriguez at this point, don't want him fired. But if he went and took another job after the season, none of us would be pissed. We wouldn't be mad. And Oklahoma State is pretty much what they were before, just a little better offense but a little less on defense.
I think the best college football story I'll be able to take away from this season here in Syracuse is that I saw Lamar Jackson hurdle the guy by the end zone, the signature play probably that's going to be taken away from his season. I was row two, other side of the stadium. Right when we saw that, everybody in our whole section just got up and left. Like, once we saw him just hurl that guy and walk into the end zone, put the ball on the ground, and it was over from there. It's been a rough season up here in Syracuse from a college football perspective, as it often is.
Basketball
is what we're waiting for. We talked to Jim Boeheim right over here at Newhouse a week ago. Everyone's scared to ask questions because you know him. He's just looking to roast the next reporter. But he told us he's not as mean as he used to be. So I guess that's something I'm going to have to look forward to eventually if I ever get to cover him. We'll see. I can only be so lucky.
You just have pictures in your questions. You can't have any back down in there.
We all need a little practice. I'm getting my reps in with ice hockey right now. It's a little less hectic of an environment. You're a Miami guy. Have spent a lot of time of your life in Miami, Cuban background, and of course we all know the great, probably the most tragic story in sports of this year. About a week, 2 weeks ago at this point, Jose Fernandez, we lost him, 24 years old. Really a guy I thought was heading as fast as you could, a little bump in the road with the Tommy John surgery, but I thought he was absolutely throttling towards being the best pitcher in baseball. And beyond that, can you tell us a little bit about just how much of a figure he was in the Miami community? I know you've been away from there for a little while now, but I'm sure you know a little bit about it.
One of my bucket lists in a sports media career was to cover the Miami Marlins at any point. And I got to do that in 2014 for the Examiner. And I didn't really get that much of Jose Fernandez because mid-May he got Tommy John surgery. I think I was in a scrum with him once. I tried to talk to him a second time, and I ran into him a third time, and it wasn't really that much of a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to see his impact firsthand because as a Marlins fan, I know what it's like to go to a game and feel like you're the only one there because the attendance is always low and there's always the excuse not to go to a Marlins game, even with the new ballpark, which is absolutely a beauty. But when he got up there and he was on the mound, everyone showed up. It was a pilgrimage to go see him pitch. And one of the games that I will always remember was, it was in May, I think it was May 4th. It was Dodgers and Marlins. With Puig and Jose Fernandez, it was like 30,000 deep, and he goes and he strikes out 10 guys in 7 innings. And Jeff Baker hit a fly ball at the bottom of the ninth, right over the right field wall, and Puig is going out there, and he leaps to the back and he catches the ball, but he crashes the wall. Ball falls off the glove, and as soon as it hits the ground, pandemonium strikes, and it's game over. Marlins win. I saw what he represented. He represented joy. He represented everything that was good and not just life, but baseball, and what it means to be a Cuban-American. Because there's, to leave Cuba, there's an easy way and there's a hard way. And to work 6 months in a sugarcane field was considered the easy way. That's how my family got out of Cuba and entered and came to America. Well, my mother's side. My father's side is Italian. And he made 3 attempts to escape Cuba. Failed. Resulted in prison time. The 4th time, he saved his mother from drowning. That was a successful time. Makes it to Mexico. He goes to Tampa, becomes a sensation. Baseball's pretty much the only thing that normalizes him in his community. He gets drafted by the Marlins. 1 year in the minors, he becomes a rookie, becomes a sensation. And you saw how he was, on the, as joyful as he was and how happy as he was, and how he would break down in tears when he first sees his grandmother for the first time, and being able to pitch with him, with her and his mother watching. One of the things that was probably his greatest accomplishment, and we're just hearing this now because Barry Bonds just got let go by the Marlins because people didn't get along with him over there, like Manny Lee could have stand him. Greatest accomplishment that Fernandez probably ever had in baseball, made that guy show public affection for somebody other than his family. You can see him, Barry, like, actually kissing Jose Fernandez or have his arm around him, have like a big smile. Barry Bonds, when he was a player, had the stature of a Greek god but the heart of a Grinch, but that guy was the only one to make his heart melt. And it was that probably something that goes beyond his ERA or his impeccable home record or his posthumous Cy Young season.
It still doesn't feel real. And
it doesn't. He died right on the South Point jetty where my father docks his boat. He and Pedro Martinez docked his boat at South Point Marina in Miami Beach, and it was that pier a few yards away where the crash happened.
The worst part about death, I mean, it's so hard to accept the fact that, like, he's just gone now. I mean, gone from the Marlins organization, gone from that community. And like you said, he was just such an important figure in baseball for so many reasons. You're going to have such a huge influx now of Cuban talent now that Cuba is finally open. And he was one of the guys who really spearheaded that movement of players out of there. You still always have to go back to that home run he hit where he was just tearing around the bases full of joy. Brian McCann, one of the old sticklers of the old baseball way, confronts him as a big scrum at home plate. And he really stood for a lot of the things that baseball is going to need to continue to grow and compete with some of the other sports in North America. Now, you need that emotion. You need those fantastic stories of triumph. And I think in this pitcher's era, he was going to really become one of the frontline guys of it. It's not crazy to say that he was already on the way to a Hall of Fame career. And to see that go out the window, the Marlins actually retired his uniform, first player ever to have his number retired by the Marlins.
I believe so. Usually teams have this this policy, and I noticed from the Diamondbacks as well, when I used to cover them, that you have to make it to the Hall of Fame before they retire the jersey number. The Diamondbacks made an exception with Luis Gonzalez, but they did it with Randy Johnson, who went in as a Diamondback. It takes something like this. Even though the painter, the artist, isn't really that big in modern-day pop culture like it used to be, but it's the same concept of the value, your value growing in the afterlife. Like, it was the same thing with Fernandez. His death has actually made him bigger, and it made him more of a legend and more of a symbol in Miami, as sad as that seems to be.
Not even four seasons into his career, and that's it. That's it right there. You know, going through some of his career stats, and, you know, it just seems meaningless to do that with, you know, the gravity beyond baseball. But the Rookie of the Year, third in Cy Young his rookie season, finished with a 2.58 ERA, 69% winning percentage. It's just such a tragedy. And, you know, I haven't really... Reggie Lewis is the closest thing I could compare it to from the Boston area from my perspective, and that was well before my time. It really magnifies just how much we buy into these athletes. And, you know, like you said, you don't know... Even covering the team, didn't have a relationship with him. And, of course, I never stepped anywhere near him, never even saw him pitch in person. Saw him pitch all the time on television. But I remember waking up the morning it happened. I got a good old 8 a.m. Spanish class, so I'm up at the break of dawn every single morning. And I remember seeing the tweets. You had the blue check marks. And people are always tweeting crazy stuff. And it was just so shocking to see a 24-year-old guy who, you know, you'll talk about all the time in baseball conversations with people. You listen off your best baseball pitchers. I'd always bring up this guy, always bring up the promise of how great he's going to be. And then to just wake up one morning and think that he's gone, it's as shocking as anything. And I remember, you know, finally going to some Miami news sites and seeing there was a three-person boat crash. And that's when it really became real for me. Do you remember the moment you first heard that he was gone, and what was your reaction when that happened?
Well, here's something crazy. I wake up pretty late. I sleep in a lot now because I don't get to work until like 2 in the afternoon. So I woke up to this news. And my friend told me like a night before that he had like a grandmother that was about to die soon in the hospital. So he wakes me up and goes, hey, I got some bad news. Like, what, your grandma died? Like, no, Jose Fernandez died. Like, what? And I was more shocked about that. And I almost didn't believe it. And I searched everything. I had like 5 texts about that. And all I could do was figure out, like, what do you mean he died in a boating accident? How did that happen? Where did it go? Like, I was almost like doing like my own self-investigation. And this is a year where you hear like famous death after famous death after famous death, but all those guys, at the very least, were like middle-aged to old. Like, they lived their life. This one was a shocker because it was a young life. A guy who was just about to live in his prime, not just as a pitcher, but as a human. Like, he became an American citizen a year ago and just gone, done. And the most ironic way possible, it was a boat brought him to freedom, and a boat brought him to death. And it was just putting all these things together. It's still very hard to resonate.
And, you know, the big thing, I think, from a media perspective at a time like this, and the story surrounding the death was just so eerie between the text he was exchanging with one of his friends in the morning, the fact that they found them at 3 a.m. in the morning, and, you know, one of the latest stories that comes out is that investigators, you know, got the toxicology reports back, and this is via the Miami Herald, but they're not saying anything about the toxicology reports. They're not releasing them for some reason or the other. So from a media perspective, and it's just such a tragic loss, you really don't want to pile on a guy who's gone at this point. What do you think should be the role of the media, you know, digging further into the situation that brought about his death, and if he had any role in it or anything? It's so hard to tell at this point, especially without the toxicology report. What do you think the media's role should be, you know, following the death of someone like that?
Well, for the reporters, because when we say media, we're talking about like a whole big conglomerate. I'm taking like the commentary gas bags out of it. Mm. The ones who are actually there doing the actual investigative reporting, the role is to find out how it happened, because 3 people died. One of them was famous. Which one? The toxicology report is important because you got to know who was intoxicated and did that person captain the boat. We do know that that boat has a history of going at reckless speeds. It's been stopped before. I was actually on a boat before, on a fishing trip with my father recently, and 35 miles an hour feels really fast, to the point where like I'm shaking around, trying to avoid hitting myself in the head on something on the, you know, like the roof or something in the boat. It was said that boat went as a speed boat, so that boat goes like 60 miles an hour. So that's insanely fast for a boat, and it's hard to steer in that thing. You gotta find out whose boat it belonged to, who captained the boat, and who was intoxicated. And if the captain and the person who was intoxicated has the same name, then there's responsibility to the deaths of the other 2 guys. Alcohol, and usually it's like there's always a life insurance involved in this, and alcohol is usually one of the things that negates the insurance. So that's why the toxicology report is important, depending on who was involved.
It was Fernandez, Emilio Macias, and Eduardo Rivera, all killed and found at 3:15 in the morning on September 25th. It was Fernandez was a member of the boat. I don't think there's any confirmation on whether it was his boat or not, especially from the story I'm looking at now with the LA Times. So many layers to it in a tragedy like this, and like you said, we'll only learn more. Hopefully that toxicology report is brought out eventually. It doesn't seem to be any indication as to why it's being withheld, but maybe one of those complications. is a reason for that. We'll keep Fernandez in our thoughts as we continue to learn more about the situation there. But that next night where D. Gordon hit that home run, special thing about sports, it always seems to be a great moment in a time of tragedy like that. I remember back with the Boston bombings, Daniel Nava hitting the big home run against the Royals that day with David Ortiz. This is our fucking city. And sports, they can provide a tragedy in a time like this, but then they'll come right back around and rejuvenate you. Mike Piazza after 9/11. It's crazy how there's always seems to be, after a tragedy, that defining moment. The Marlins missed the playoffs this year. They were in it throughout the season, the race for that second wild card spot. And this is obviously a loss going back to a player personnel perspective, which is tough to do in such a human tragedy like this. But this is the kind of loss that sets back a franchise. Where do you think the Marlins go from here? I mean, that's the centerpiece of your franchise gone. You were competitive throughout the season this year. Missed a playoff spot by just two spots, maybe. Where do they go from here?
Well, the priority needs to be retaining more talent. Like they recently re-signed Martin Prado to a three-year deal. That's important. They already have Giancarlo Stanton and Christian Yelich re-signed recently. The next move is to decide whether or not you want to continue with Marcell Ozuna, who had a pretty decent power number. And they're stuck with D. Gordon, so you hope that he has like a bounce-back season, and the PEDs didn't really have that much of an effect. He's still a really fast guy, so maybe he'll have a much better season next year. They still have Justin Bour, who could probably be like their first baseman in the future. In like a second year, he was injured. It probably kept him from hitting 20 home runs. But that 20 home run, 25 home run power is still there, so hopefully he has a breakout year next year. And JT Realmuto, who I actually did a story on for the Eden News and Eagle yesterday, he's an Oklahoma native. He would have actually gone to Oklahoma State if he didn't get drafted by the Marlins. He had a breakout season. He's a very athletic guy. Don Mattingly liked to put him in a leadoff spot, which is rare for a catcher. He actually led all catchers in stolen base with 12. 12 is not that big of a number, but it shows you the kind of speed he has for that position. He finished the season batting 303 with 11 home runs and 40 RBI. That's pretty good catching numbers. So that's a guy who they now have like the catcher, their franchise catcher, Realmuto, assuming he keeps this up. We have a great bullpen. Adrian Ramos had 40 saves. Kyle Bearclaw was fourth on the Marlins in strikeouts. He had like over 110 strikeouts in just 72 innings, which is crazy. So those two guys, and actually David Phelps is also a really good bullpen arm as well. So they have a good bullpen. They have some good hitting. They need to get starting pitching. They can get some guys off the cheap, like Jeremy Hellickson from the Phillies, who had a pretty decent season. They can get someone like him. They could probably make a big splash and get like a great starting pitcher off the free agent market, but they have to do something with their starting pitching if they're going to advance into playoff competition next year.
We thank you for joining us today, Tony. Normally we like to be all fun and games here on the Bobcast, but with a sports story as heavy as the Jose Fernandez one, you just had to address in with a guy. It's been great to talk to you throughout this process, just with your relation to Miami, the Cuban community there, and we appreciate you being the first two-time guest on the Bobcast. Anything else you want to say before you drop the mic and get out of here?
Well, make me the first guy to be there for a third time, and we'll definitely have some more fun and games.
All righty. Tony Capobianco, Enid News. You can read his work there. Follow him on Twitter at Tony Capobianco. Am I correct?
Yes.
And we'll send him on out into his night. Enjoy, Tony.
Adios.
That is our show for tonight, The Bobcast. You can follow us on Twitter at The Bobcast Show. Follow our good umbrella company, CLNS Radio. Celtic season's getting started like we talked about in the intro at CLNS Radio. We're getting back to our post-game shows. I'll be co-hosting the post-game show, which you can find on clnsradio.com or through Blog Talk Radio. You can just search Celtics postgame show on there. We get the best Celtics postgame show, so it'll come right up. And we're even live streaming select shows through ESPN Radio New Hampshire this fall, which is incredibly exciting. And I'll be on the October 17th show with Matt Rory after the preseason game against the Brooklyn Nets. Shout out to our founder, Nick Gelso, and some of the crew there for supporting us. You can follow them on Twitter at CLNS Radio. And we are off into the night, returning to Boston this weekend. It's the semester's flying. It's incredible. So much work to do. So much to learn. And, you know, my head's just been kind of all over the place, but I appreciate you guys, like I said last week, bearing with me as I try to pump out one of these podcasts every week. And we try to continue to talk to someone with an interesting story. We're working hard to get new guests, but we are going to have another repeat guest on next week. Mel Smith, he's starting a fantastic social project outside of music that has very powerful ties to society today, and I can't wait to pick his brain on that. It's called Boys Don't Cry. Not the Frank Ocean album. This is the Mel Smith project. That actually was not the name of the Frank Ocean album when it came out. Anyways, I could go on and talk about the Frank Ocean album all night long, but that is our show for this week. I'm Bobby Manning. This has been the Bobcast from the Newhouse School at Syracuse University. As I always say, peace.
Super loud. Come on now. Let's go. Hear you say, Yeah. Okay, mama. Let me hear you say, yeah.